Chapter 31. Being the winter night mostly sucks, but it comes with a few perks that can be damned handy. First, I'm strong. Not like Spider-Man strong, but I'm about as strong as someone built like me can be. And I'm not exactly a tiny guy. I'd gotten myself mostly dead as part of the deal, and by the time I'd gotten back to the world of the living, my body had wasted down to nothing. Part of recovery had been physical training, a whole hell of a lot of it. And since the constant primal pressure of the mantle could be safely eased through intense exercise, I'd kept it up. It didn't turn me into an instant superhero or anything, but you don't want me punching you in the nose, either. Second, I can have issues noticing pain and discomfort. Mostly that means things like cutting myself a whole lot while shaving. Sometimes when I stand up after reading for a long time, I don't notice that my leg has gone to sleep and I fall down. I have to really pay attention to notice pain most of the time. It's probably been good for me to work on a little more self-awareness, but it isn't much fun. On the other hand, when you're doing something to which pain is a serious obstacle, like running, it can be really convenient. The average fit young person can manage about 16 or 18 miles an hour over a short distance. Top human sprint speed is about 28 miles an hour. I can't run that fast, but I can run considerably faster than average, maybe 22 or 24 miles an hour, and I can do it without slowing down for more or less as long as is necessary. So when I hit the streets, I was really moving. I knew it wouldn't take me long to reach the waterfront. In fact, my biggest worry was that I would break an ankle and not notice it until I kept running and pounded my foot to pulp. But Chicago's streets had changed. Cars had simply come to a halt, dead in their rows. There were no streetlights, no lights in buildings, no signs, no traffic lights, no nothing. People had gotten out of their cars and were standing together in small groups, nervously talking. Everyone was holding a phone in their hands. None of the devices were working. The only human-made illumination came from, here and there, emergency road flares that people had deployed as light sources. If there hadn't been a waxing moon, it would have been too dark to move as fast as I was. It was eerily silent. Chicago was a busy place. At any time of the day or night, you could hear any number of the sounds of the modern world. Radios blaring, deep bass notes from someone's tricked-out car stereo, traffic, horns, sirens, construction equipment, public announcements, tests of the emergency broadcast system, what have you. All of that was gone. The only sounds were worried voices and my running footsteps. There weren't any screams, there wasn't any smoke. Not yet, but it was coming. My God, it was coming. If Ethnew and the Fomor hit the city during the blackout, the resulting chaos could kill tens of thousands independently of whether anyone swung a blade or fired a shot. The sudden blackout had to have killed people in hospitals, in automobile collisions, maybe even in airplanes. I mean, how would I know? I couldn't see the highways. A plane could have gone down a few blocks away, and if I hadn't seen it happen, and if there weren't any fires to mark it, I'd never be able to tell from here. The accorded nations were preparing for all-out war. Freaking Ferrovax was involved. I ran for the docks, and as I did, I realized something truly terrifying. I had no idea what was coming next. This was out of my experience, beyond what I knew of the world. The supernatural nations might have their issues, and when we fought, sometimes there was collateral damage, but for the most part, we kept it among ourselves. Old ruins, jungles, deserts, underground caverns, that was where we did most of our fighting. Not in cities. Not in the streets of freaking Chicago. I mean, my God, she'd kicked Mab through walls. Mab? Walls? Plural. Ethnew had gone through her as if she didn't exist. A creature with power like that might not be impressed by a mere 7 or 8 billion mortals. She might very well be determined to play this one old school, and a proto-god's idea of old school probably checked in around the same weight class as Sodom and Gomorrah. Before the night was out, the city would fight for its life. My grandfather and my friends and allies on the council would be in the middle of it. My God, I had to get Thomas clear of it before it got started. I had to warn people. I mean, the supernatural community grapevine would be spreading this one like wildfire, and everyone would be paying attention because I'd spread the word for everyone to keep their eyes open. But that left the rest of Chicago. 99% and then some of the city's populace would have no idea what was going on when the attack began. Like zero idea. And being initiated to the supernatural world was difficult even when it happened gently, much less when it rolled up and ripped someone's face off. About 8 million people would react with panic, with terror, with violence. And my daughter would be in the middle of it. The very thought gave my feet wings. Only two things kept me from going to her. First, where she was staying. She was a guest in the house of Michael Carpenter and under his protection. And that meant that while she was there, she had a mostly retired hero and a squad of literal guardian angels looking out for her. I don't care how badass you might be, even on the kind of scales I use, you don't want to tussle with an angel. Those beings are absolute forces of the universe, and they are freaking Old Testament. Tangling with one would be less like getting into a street fight than like getting into a fight with the street. It's difficult to picture. You're almost certain to look incredibly foolish, and however you approach that fight, things are probably not going to go your way. Maggie could hardly be in a safer place in the city than under their protection. And the second reason was my brother. I had been trying to keep cool while we executed the rescue plan, but I was terrified for him. He was in bad shape. I could not save him exactly, but I could keep him alive on the island. That was the whole point. Out there, I had a lot more say about what happened. Out there, I could keep him shielded from tracking magic, from deadly spells, from hostile sendings, could forbid the presence of the Svartalfs and enforce it. Out there, he'd have a chance. With luck, I could save my brother and make it back to town before Ethneu and Korb did. I hated the thought, but the imminent attack ought to provide us with a damn fine distraction. We just had to get him to the island before anyone caught us. But he wasn't there yet. I rounded the last corner at my best pace, feet pounding hard against the concrete, dashed across the street, and made it to the entrance of the docks at Burnham Harbor, where the Water Beetle was moored. I flew through the gates, guided through the dark by the white paint on the stairs and floorboards of the walkway. There was no one else here, no one else trying to get away from the city. Not yet. My footsteps on the dock hammered out over the open water, loud and clear, and I didn't bother trying to be quiet. Speed was everything. I flew down the last length of dock to the boat and saw green glowing light coming from below decks and from the cabin. The Water Beetle was a worn-out little old blue-water fishing trawler, pretty much a twin to the Orca in Jaws. As I slowed, panting, my footsteps got even louder, and Freitas's slim form appeared on the deck, holding a green chemical emergency light in her hand. Murphy came limping out of the cabin a second later, her P-90 riding on its harness across her chest, holding a second glow light.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Harry," she breathed. "That blast of light, was that an EMP?
"Or a hex," I said, "or both. Where's Lara?"
"She took Thomas below," Murphy said, her voice tense. "He's in rough shape."
I nodded and put a foot on the gangplank. "Okay, then let's..."
And from behind me came a deep, warbling, throbbing hum, like nothing I'd heard before. My dad, the illusionist. I slipped the dark opal ring I'd gotten from Molly off my hand and palmed it. Then I turned. Hovering maybe 20 feet up, with his feet planted firmly on a stone the size of a Buick
was the Blackstaff Ebenezer McCoy. One hand was spread out to one side for balance, fingers crooked in a mystic sign, sort of a kinetic shorthand for whatever spell was keeping that boulder in the air. The other gripped his staff, carved with runes like mine, and they glowed with a sullen red-orange energy. His face had twisted into a rictus of cold, hard fury. Flickers of static electricity played along the surface of the stone.
"You fool," he said. "You damn fool."
I put my feet back on the dock. Then I knelt down and tied my shoe.
"Boy," he said, "they're using you."
I set the palmed ring down behind my heel out of sight, breathed a word in barely a whisper. There was a moment of dizziness, and then I stood up and faced my grandfather. I gathered my will. The shield bracelet on my left wrist began drizzling a rain of green and gold sparks of light. The runes of my staff began to glow with the same energy.
"Sir," I said, "what are your intentions?" "To salvage something out of this mess, boy," he snapped. "The jaws of the trap are already closing in. I'm going to open your eyes."
His gaze flicked past me to the ship, and a flicker of electricity along the stone made a thrumming crack like a miniature thunderbolt.
"The vampire's in there, isn't he?"
"You haven't seen him there," I said. "You have no idea."
"Don't play games with me, boy," the old man spat. "I'm not one of your new fey friends, and I'm not a lawyer."
"He's working for me," came a clear, calm voice. I glanced over my shoulder to see Lara Wraith, still dressed in her party gown, standing on the water beetle's deck, arms akimbo. I didn't see any weapons on her. I didn't see where the dress would have allowed her to hide any weapons. But she stood there like she was ready to draw and fire, and all things considered, I would have judged it the better part of valor to assume the implied threat was valid.
"I worked with Mab on some visa issues some of her people were having," Lara said. "She owed me a favor. He's it."
The old man's gaze remained on mine for a moment, growing harder and hotter and more hostile. I saw the rage gathering behind his eyes before he moved them slowly to Lara.
"Vampire," he said. "The Accords are the only reason I haven't relieved you of your arms and legs and kicked you into the lake. Your brother stands accused of murder. He's going to answer for that."
The voice that came out of my grandfather when he said that, I'd heard it before. I'd been that voice before. I thought of ghouls buried to their necks in the earth. I thought of the savage satisfaction that had filled me while I did it. Because they had done wrong, and I'd seen them do it to children. And to deliver just retribution for that crime had been to be the right arm of the Almighty himself, to be filled with pure, righteous, unarguably just hatred. My God, I knew how he felt. I knew how bright and pure that fire burned. But when it was happening, I hadn't been able to feel it burning me. I just had to live with the scars afterward. The vampires of the White Court had hurt my grandfather to the heart, and he was determined that it would not happen again, and that they would pay for what they had done. If Mab had been standing there advising me, she would have said something like,
"It is his weakness. Use it against him."
And she wouldn't have been wrong. Ebenezer glared his hatred at Lara, and I realized with a sinking heart that there was only one way this was going to play out. His eyes were full of hate. It made him blind. There wasn't room in them for anything else. "Cast off," I said in a calm, firm voice, my eyes never leaving my grandfather. "Go ahead with the plan. I'll catch up."
"Dresden?" Lara asked. "Are you sure?"
"Damn it, Lara," I said, exasperated. I checked over my shoulder in time to see Murphy step up beside Lara, catch her eye, and nod firmly.
"Freydis," Lara said. The Valkyrie moved for the ropes.
"Do that," Ebenezer called, "and I'll sink this boat right now."
"No," I said calmly, firmly. I swallowed and faced the old man.
"You won't."
The old man's brows furrowed, and the air suddenly became as brittle and jagged as broken glass.
"If I let you do this," the old man said to me, his voice desperate, "you're out of the council. You're an outlaw. The Svartalfs won't care about who hired you. They'll know you prevented them from having justice, and they'll kill you for it. It's the only outcome their worldview will accept. Don't you see, boy? You'll be vulnerable, compromised. Mab and this creature, they're isolating you. That's what abusers do."
My heart broke. "I think," I said quietly, "that I'm just about done making my choices based on your mistakes." He stared at me. "You don't know me," I said quietly. "Not really. You haven't been there for most of it. And you don't know Thomas." Behind me were two quiet thumps, as lines were dropped on the deck of the ship.
"I know enough to know a frog with a scorpion when I see one," he replied. "You've been around them for a decade and change, and you think you know them. But I've dealt with their ilk for centuries. They'll turn on you, frog, even if it destroys them. They don't get a choice about it. It's what they are."
Lara stared at the old man with furious, haunted eyes. Murphy strode into the wheelhouse and started the water beetle's ancient engines. It was an old diesel, didn't even have spark plugs. Hexes, EMP, none of it mattered. If a one-eyed, palsied squirrel was all you had to do maintenance, that engine would run until its molecules decayed into their component atoms. Ebenezer's eye flickered to the ship and hardened. I sucked in a breath, ready to unleash power. My God, was this really about to happen? Was the old man really about to throw down with me? He wouldn't listen. Stars and stones, I couldn't get him to accept that a White Court vampire might be partially human. If I told him that Thomas was his grandson, he would not receive the news well. The old man had a volcanic temper. That wasn't a metaphor. If that happened, I really wasn't sure what came next. The water beetle's engine didn't roar so much as sputter and cough loudly to life. Compared with the almost silent murmur of the water against the docks and the ships, the sound was deafening in the unnatural silence over the city. Ebenezer McCoy snapped his staff across his body, held vertically, a duelist's salute. My heart lurched into overdrive. I returned my grandfather's salute with my own staff. And then me and the old man went to war.